Well, this is a little piece of dialogue that was added into the extended version.
That's from the book.
Yeah, that wasn't in the theatrical version. I am Saruman, or which Saruman as he should have been.
Is both vague and makes a weird kind of sense at the same time. It's fleshed, the whole idea is fleshed out a little better in the book, but, I mean, you know, you can flesh a whole lot of these ideas out in a movie, but then again, you'd add maybe about 5-10 minutes a piece or so, make these movies even longer.
I'd sit through it.
Well, you yeah. basically just have the basic. The only way you're gonna get all of the book into a movie is if you do what Brana did in Hamlet and just do a completely unabridged version.
Mm-hmm. How long is that sucker anyway? It's like 5 hours.
That's 4 hours.
4 hours.
And I have sat through it.
Yeah.
It's actually not that bad. I was kind of taken back by this when I first saw it in the theater.
Yeah, I didn't know. Really
the whole cosmic type thing.
I like how
contact.
It was handled. I like how it was handled. You know,
I mean, you know, I've gotten used to it to where it's like, eh, it makes some sort of sense.
Right, I mean,
I think it works extremely
like
well.
A death and revival type
yeah.
thing, you know. But, yeah, I mean, the cosmic flow through. I had a Superman getting
like,
a Superman.
Okay,
going
so we're
that.
Going from a fantasy film to a science fiction film? What's going
no,
on?
No, it still feels totally fantastical to me. I mean,
well,
I've never...
I mean, it's fantastical stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. So for me, that just didn't quite...
It works for me.
It was... I don't know. I mean, I just sort of accepted it as part of the movie.
It made me believe... It made me believe what Gandalf went through even more. I think... It felt stronger to me just because of that... Well, Gimli becomes more comic relief in this one than...
Yeah, he really does.
And it's not to the point where it's, you know, it's not Merry and Pippin comic relief.
Yeah.
It's his own kind of, you know, it's very true to the character.
I really like that little line Aragorn says to Gandalf. I've always just really enjoyed that. Well, actually, it wasn't in the theatrical version. I like that little thing because it sort of points out the sort of friendship these two have.
Which is a lot more developed in the books, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that we talked about in Fellowship that Aragorn... when he first encounters the hobbits, has a letter from Gandalf basically telling them who he is and saying, yeah, he's all right. He's
mm-hmm.
on the level.
Is it a TriStar movie?
Does sort of seem like that with the horse, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was...
Shadowfax.
I was always wondering, were they
going to
do anything special for Shadowfax? I mean, I don't know what they could do.
No, there's not a whole lot you could do.
Yeah.
I mean...
But...
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's like, again, it's one of those things that's more developed in the book, because Shadowfax is actually one of the horses of Rohan. And,
huh?
And, well, you hear of this little exchange between Theoden, I assume after he's been taken over by Saruman, basically sending Gandalf away, and Gandalf saying, yeah, he, not this banally, but, you know, I can have whatever horse I want, and he takes Shadowfax. So. But yeah, that was the first use of the White Rider theme, which comes back later. We didn't really talk about him before, Treebeard. I mean, beautiful character. Really could have been horrible.
It really could have been just dreadful.
Why don't you touch on what you thought of the way the character was handled in the animated.
The Ralph Bakshi version. It's basically a tree going back and forth and stuff like that. I mean, no real sense of the tree being, you know, like they have here, sort of be human. Just basically a tree who just sort of uplifts its roots and, you know, just moves as you would see a tree move. Like, literally.
Well, I really enjoy the acknowledgement of the animated films and the director and the actor commentaries, because they were... I remember Sean Astin speaking about how he just really, you know, sunk into the lure of everything. He read the novels, and he looked at the animated films and everything. And when he saw the way Sam was handled in the animated version,
dear God.
We talked about that. Yeah. And how worried he was about how he would come across.
They just did such a horrible job with Sam's character in the Bakshi version. I'm really glad that Sean Astin didn't use that as a model to play the character. Because I just felt it was so off character for Sam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and they really just captured the character beautifully.
I mean, you know, I never thought. Very rarely do I not have an idea how they might do something like Treebeard or something like that in the movie.
Yeah.
But I really had no idea what the Treebeard would even look like. You know.
Well,
he was never in any of the trailers, was he?
No.
Very little.
There
was also a shot in the special sneak preview they did that they added to the end of Fellowship during the end of its run, where you saw that sort of double back by Pip. You know, you saw the eyes open and then you see that double back. But, I mean, no, you really didn't see Treebeard. You didn't really see Gollum either. I mean, they really wanted to blow you away with that in the movie. This is a little bit more of the dialogue that you get in the book.
Sort of. You know what I like this scene is that they finally acknowledge. This is one of the first times you finally hear them acknowledge. The rest of the fellowship, you know, being off on their own, you know, journeys or what have you. Just any moment where, you know, all eight characters are being acknowledged, but they're not all on the screen. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm absolutely into it just because, I'm a big fan of, you know, the idea of, you know, friendship in the face of, you know, adversity.
Yeah.
And just the fact that, you know, they're acknowledging everyone else being off on their own adventure, you know, I absolutely dig it.
I love the addition of this scene because of the fact that it points up one of the really interesting ideas that Tolkien touched on in that same dialogue in the book about how Sauron is under the impression that the Fellowship wants to use the ring against him. He has no idea that they really want to destroy it. And I was really glad to hear that was going to come back in the extended edition. Now,
that was a spectacular miniature.
Oh, yeah. The Black Gates. Well, let's see. Spectacular miniature, spectacular acting, spectacular
blue screen work,
sequence, spectacular scoring.
Well, what were we going to say, though, about not gushing over every little... I mean...
We're not. We're looking at this reasonably critically.
Okay.
Or we're trying to. Now, do you remember the sequence this in the book, Dave?
Only a little.
If I'm not mis- don't they don't have the little bit of suspense here where Sam goes down the hill and they're worried that the Easterlings might find them, right? They just, as far from what I remember,
they do the
cloak
covering thing, you know.
Do they?
Yeah.
God, I don't know.
I really don't remember that. I was looking for that and looking to see how they were going to do that. You know,
yeah.
In the middle.
I just completely, for this chapter, I really hate to admit, I mean, other than the fact that Gollum says, you know, there's another way into Mordor, you know, which I know is in the book, but
I thought this is where
you start to see him sort of trying to lead Frodo astray, and you start to see the rift between Frodo and Sam.
Right.
I'm not sure if he's
falling down the mountain and then there's a problem or if there's the
well,
cloak
see, the thing
comes in later. I know the cloak thing has to come in somewhere.
I think so too. I think you're right,
but I just don't remember
being here.
Falling down the hill.
I didn't remember that part from the book.
Right.
But, this is a nice little
moment.
Thing because, yeah.
Yeah.
See, they're like, you know, that's not gonna work.
And if you think about it, it's kind of implausible because the way they, this sequence is staged, they will have had to have seen them before they put the cloaks on.
Right.
So, I mean, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but it's a cool little sequence anyway. But, yeah.
That's really a cloak. Did you know that? Did you not know that, Dave? It's really a magical cloak. The elves gave them. The Rivendell. Did you see the first movie, Dave?
Yeah.
The extended version of the first movie? This is... Oh, God, I love Howard Shore's writing in this scene.
That was where...
real dark, dramatic music, and then you get the high strings, which is just
amazing. Makes it totally emotional. But there's a great outtake of Andy Serkis ripping Sean Astin's wig out.
Yeah, and he was not happy about it either.
Yeah.
Well, they talk about it in the cast commentary, too.
Yeah.
I love in this part of Howard Shore's music how you have this sort of moving underneath, you know, the sort of dangerous aspect. Then you have the high strings, which is just, you know, just beautiful counterpoint between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm really getting geeky about it. But
well,
still,
you know, the fact of the matter is Howard Shore wasn't even a
really just...
The fact of the matter is Howard Shore wasn't even nominated for an Oscar for this, which...
God knows why.
Yeah.
Even though it was clearly the best score from that 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I bet fellow composers are glad that he's got the year off before King Kong comes out because of the fact that maybe somebody else will get a chance for some recognition.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an interesting article in Film Score Monthly that talked about the quote-unquote curse of the sequel score.
Yeah, which I just figured that to be the case with Two Towers not being nominated. Then he gets nominated and wins for Return of the King, and I'm like, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, well, and how come you didn't nominate Two Towers? How come you didn't nominate Episode 1? It's like there are a lot of great sequel scores.
This is
like,
a beautiful shot coming up right here.
Yeah, it really is.
That's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. It's totally surreal, but it worked. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just...
Leipzig. These two really are great in these characters. It was really cool to see Billy Boyd doing something other than Pippin. He was also in Peter Weir's Master and Commander.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's got a pretty decent-sized role in that movie, too. It's not just a throwaway thing. I mean, it's a very good movie. It's worth seeing anyway, but still.
Now, the end draft, I'm still not...
I vaguely remember this sequence. Yeah, I mean, I know it's in the book, but I vaguely remember, you know, the details about it. Well, the idea with the Entroth is basically it's sort of mystical water, you know, because it is acknowledged in the books that, you know, at least in Return of the King, when they get back together with Frodo and Sam at the end, how, you know, they're tall, all of a sudden taller than they normally were.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
I really am embarrassed to say I completely forget about Old Man Willow from Fellowship of the Ring. It's like, but this is sort of a throwback to it.
But Tom, but Treebeard is about to speak some
Tom Bombadil dialogue.
Yeah.
They didn't completely get rid of Tom, just the character.
Seeing how they did with all the other challenges, I wouldn't have mind seeing how they would have done, you know, Tom.
Yeah.
Just see if they could pull it off, you know, since they managed to pull off so much other stuff.
Well, I mean, again, it's one of those things where it's like, that's for an unabridged version of the book,
right.
Movie.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's so much that you can do in a movie. I mean... You know,
well, I remember listening to...
These movies just being 3 hours was a risk.
Right. Well, I remember, like, listening to commentaries for Fellowship and, you know, looking at the extras on the DVD. And, you know, a lot of the reasons why certain things are left out. I mean, I don't mean to speak as if I know a single thing about the books, but it's always made sense to me when they, after they've explained it, why certain things have been left, like Fellowship, the reason a lot of sequences that were favorites of the fans that were left out was because it wasn't keeping the movie Frodo carrying the ring centric, you know.
Yeah. And, I mean, I can see why they got rid of the Tom Bombadil
sequence.
Because of the fact that it doesn't really move the plot forward. It's, you know, there are a lot of starts and stops and stuff like that in the journey.
And then what's touched on in this DVD also, the extras for Two Towers, is why Shelob is left for Return of the King and not used at the end of... this particular movie.
Which, if you know the appendices for the book, for Lord of the Rings, and, you know, one of the appendices is basically a timeline of events, makes a whole hell of a lot of sense that Shelob was in Return of the King, because it is happening concurrently with the siege on Minas Tirith. I'm stunned that they built all of this. Like, the Golden Hall and all of that stuff. I mean, you know, one of the things that I've found remarkable about these movies is, you know, there's people like Spielberg and David Lynch and stuff like that, they don't do commentaries as they don't want to, you know, sort of ruin the experience of watching the movies, you know, basically telling you all about it, and it's like, I can kind of see that, you know, if they had said the same thing about Lord of the Rings, I could have understood it, But the fact of the matter is, they just... What they say, when you find out how they did, it's even more spectacular.
Right. You know, I mean, and a lot of times they're like giving credit to the guys you never hear about.
Oh, yeah.
They're building the sets and working in the background, stuff like that.
So which is why, justly, there's four commentaries, so. One for each part of the movie making.
Right.
Which, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, you have to give credit to all these people. You just have to. I mean, we haven't talked about Theoden, played by Bernard Hill, who's best known as the captain of the Titanic in James Cameron's film. Brad Dourif here is Grima Wormtongue, who I've seen him in. He's best known for the voice of Chucky Child's Play movies.
Mm. Oh my goodness.
But he's also, I believe he was in Alien Resurrection and Color of Night, the really awful Bruce Willis movie. But,
Ryan Otto from one of your favorite movies,
I wouldn't say it's my favorite, but my favorite filmmakers, Human Nature,
mm-hmm.
which was written by Charlie Kaufman.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily one of my favorite movies, but I really do enjoy the movie, I will say.
Yeah. Well, I didn't...
But I love Charlie Kaufman.
I was wondering about the... Because I do read a lot of fantasy novels, and mm-hmm. I was wondering about Tolkien's influence, you know, on other fantasy authors. And I mean, you know, there's some fantasy authors who would go to like Tolkien, like lectures, you know, to hear him talk.
Yeah.
And you know, and go back to writing their books after that. And you see a lot of these different types of characters happen throughout other different book series, and
mm-hmm.
especially the Wormtongue character, a king or ruler who's been poisoned by, you know, his closest consultant. I mean, that's something you see all the time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you don't read fantasy novels, and I mean, I don't, but, I mean, I've read these, but I don't read the genre in general, but I mean, even in something like the Star Wars movies,
right.
you can clearly see the influence of Tolkien on those movies, on the story.
Mm-hmm.
And, the thing, you know, while I think part of the reason Lord of the Rings stands out, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, is Tolkien didn't necessarily, when he was writing these, he didn't look at them as fantasy movies.
Right, right, right.
I mean, obviously you have the fantastical elements of, like, the wizards and the orcs and stuff like that, but, I mean, he was looking at these as history.
Right.
Which is part of the reason that the story holds up so beautifully.
Exactly. And I mean yeah, you know, we're not looking at like lots of magic going on.
Oh, here, no.
You know, and, I mean, the whole magical elements are very, very much reality based.
Yeah.
You know, and there's sort of a level of physics involved, you know, mm-hmm. a level of reality involved.
That's very much how Peter Jackson treated the making of these movies. You know, he treated them, you know. That's supposedly very much along the lines of how he's going to treat King Kong, is not as a fantasy, but as a drama.
Which is part of the reason I can't wait to see that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you were talking about how the magic is, you know, based in reality. This is one of the things coming up, which is where Gandalf frees Theoden from the Hold of Saruman, which is... one of the few instances where magic is really used as how we perceive magic as, based
right.
on fantasy.
But it's not Harry Potter magic.
No.
Fantasy, like, you know.
No.
You know, and I mean,
it's not cartoony or.
When you compare, I mean, we compare like the whole Dungeons and Dragons magic, which was a whole system in and of itself.
Oh yeah,
that's very fantastical. Even the Harry Potter stuff is not quite as fantastical. Some of that stuff can be.
Yeah.
And then you get to another author, you know, Robert Jordan, The Wheel of Time, which is a very famous trilogy, and that's even more physical-based, reality-based
mm-hmm.
than even this is. So there's like a range, a spectrum
that authors use, and some of the most famous ones are ones that are more reality based.
Yeah.
Not everybody's into the Dungeons and Dragons magic system, so. Mm-hmm. But when they can kind of relate to it a little bit.
Yeah.
You know. I love this moment. It's such a great action hero movie moment.
Well, it's when they're just Ian McKellen moment.
Well, not just Ian McKellen, but like, you know, the boys just like,
oh, yeah,
just
taking people out.
That's just great. I love that.
And they're not really killing anybody.
Yeah, like, they're just beating the crap out of them. Oh, that's a great moment there.
Well, see what's made these movies so popular is that, you know, they combine everything from fantasy to drama to action movie chase to
the thing is, like, in a video store you would put these under action adventure. Not without reason, but I consider them more dramas than I do anything. I mean, I consider these, you know, along the line of Saving Private Ryan or something, where it's like, you know, the action is subordinate to the story,
right,
which is dramatic. Right. So,
and I mean, I think that's what makes it. That's what gives it the respect. And if that other fantasy movies in Hollywood don't get, it's kind of this drama base.
Well, hopefully, like I believe you were saying at the end of the Fellowship commentary, how hopefully we'll see more fantasy films that take that route.
Right. You know, especially ones that are made for books. I mean, some of these books are really brilliant. And you know, they need good treatments, not sort of cheesy treatments, you know, that you see nowadays.
But hopefully, the popularity of these movies and the Harry Potter movies will really sort of wisen Hollywood up. But I mean, also, it also comes down to, you know, who's making the film, who's writing the script and stuff like that. Because, I mean, you know, this is really getting off base, but I mean, you know, example I would say of, you know, a good idea that just didn't translate was League of Extraordinary Gentlemen this past summer, where it's like, you know, I mean, the director who directed Blade, which, granted, a lot of people are fans of, I wasn't a huge fan of it, and it's like, but I was still looking to give the movie a chance because of the fact that I really like the idea of it.
Right.
And the thing is, it was, for me, that movie was just so terribly generic, and I think that's a lot of problems with a lot of the fantasy movies that we've seen. Is they just, it's so cliched and so uninspired. It takes somebody like a Peter Jackson or a Sam Raimi in case of Spider-Man. and Spielberg it takes somebody with imagination to really make it work. And who takes the genre seriously.
Sam Raimi. Anyway,
I'm just saying. I would need examples. Sam Raimi is an example.
He's an example, but
I was actually going to mention him.
Not for the movie, but that's okay. It's okay, Brian.
You mean the exceedingly popular movie that
I mentioned? Didn't deserve half the attention it got?
Yeah, we've already done Spider-Man.
Yeah, we've already done Spider-Man. We can wait until Spider-Man 2 for some more on that. I was actually going to mention...
Great moment here.
Oh, God, yes. And I love the way he does the Rohan.
Which could have been... It could have been so cheesy.
Yeah.
But works so well.
Well, again, I mean, you know, the thing with Howard Shore is one of these people where it's like he's taking the story seriously.
Right.
And it's that is half battle when it comes to these movies. It's half battle. But I was going to mention Sam Raimi during this commentary because of the fact that, like, in terms of Peter Jackson's directorial style, you can sort of see how Sam Raimi and the Coen brothers inspired him as far as the way he does some of the cinematography and stuff like that. It's really evident in his early features, too. Yeah.
I remember a story, Brad Dourif in the actress Wendy is not kicking.
Oh God!
And when, yeah. Well, there's a really funny story of Peter Jackson talking about
the flag.
The fact that the flag was done completely in camera is great, you know. But some really funny stories of like Peter Jackson's glasses being blown completely off his face and down it, and then or Brad Dourif in that spit take, going completely the other direction. That's how I want to be buried, by the way. You guys are paying attention. I'm going to be buried like that with a sword. And I don't know if I've done anything in my life to deserve that kind of burial, but
I wonder if any of us have. But anyway, this moment really took me back. This beautiful addition to the extended edition.
What language is
Norse, probably? Mm-hmm. Or I mean, you know, the Middle Earth equivalent. Oh, Old English, actually. Mm-hmm. I think this went when I saw this for the first time, which is, this is probably my favorite new edition. Mm-hmm. This song that Miranda Otto just paralyzed me when I heard it for the first time. I mean, just so, such a daring choice. Such a beautiful choice, too.
Well, that moment grows on me every time I see it. I mean, it felt a little bit too... I mean, that's going back to my conflicting thoughts and feelings about the extended version versus the theatrical version. You know, sometimes it did feel a little forced. I wasn't gonna say it.
You were wanting to say it, though.
But you were wanting to say it for you. But you know, I mean, yeah, I mean this. But this is the only version I bought, just because, you know, I mean, I waited for the extended version. I did not.
Yeah.
I did not go right out and buy the theatrical version like everyone else I knew at the time. You know, they were just, you know, they're counting down the minutes to when the theatrical version was going to be released on home video. And I mean,
you can just say my name,
huh?
In this conversation, you might as well just say it.
No, I mean, I know,
one such person.
I know. Well, I know you are, but I really am thinking of a couple other people I know.
Yeah.
I really am. I mean, I think you get enough flack from me on other things, but I'm just talking about like some other friends I knew who literally were like, you know, tomorrow's the, you know, it was in August or May.
August. Yeah.
You know, and I was like, and I was telling people, you know, well, not me, I think I'm going to wait for the, extended version, you know, it's coming out in November, and I'm just really looking forward to that. And people are like looking at me. That's when I really start to feel like, you know, I know what I'm talking about. Even though I can't put it into words like you can, Brian, or Dave can. That's when I really do start to feel like, you know, I'm a part of some kind of, you know, see, you know, like, you know, you and I are like waiting on pins and needles for the special edition DVD release of Ed Wood, you know.
Yeah.
That's been delayed.
Well,
there's over
a
and
good
over
reason
again.
For that, and that's been delayed twice.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's like there's like almost kind of like a secret society now of, you know, of DVD nuts who, you know. I don't know. I just get a kick out of that. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Dick Sears himself to be the head of the secret society.
Well, I mean,
proud to be part of that group.
I will say for my part that, I mean, the reason I do have both versions of both of the first two movies, and I'll have both versions of Return of the King too when it comes out, because of the fact.
I'm a completist.
I mean, that's how I am. That's why I've got like three or four different versions of Star Wars on tape.
My favorite line coming up. That's my boy right there.
Yeah.
He gets mad for it, but it's Jesus.
Vigo's just, I mean, what can you say about Vigo?
Again, there's actually a very, I mean, Dave, I know you got the, I know you don't have the extended version, you don't have the special edition in Fellowship, but you do have this at home.
Right.
And there's actually a really neat little moment on the extras of showing Viggo saying that line like five or six different ways.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, there is. I mean, I know that if that's your favorite line, I think you might get a kick out of that.
Yeah.
But,
no, I was trying to think of what else Viggo's been in. And I mean,
well, he just recently was in Hildago.
Yeah, which I still actually haven't gotten to. But no, 28 Days with Sandra Bullock, G.I. Jane Demi Moore, A Perfect Murder,
mm-hmm.
was remade from Dial In for Murder.
But no, Brian, I mean, I apologize, but like, you know, right. you know what I'm like getting at, like, you know, I was telling people that I was waiting for the 3-hour, 45-minute version of, you know, of the movie to come out for me to actually buy the DVD. You know, people just look at me like I'm nuts. You know, and I mean, they were like, "What is this? What are you talking about? The, you know, 4-disc version?" And I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I just get a kick out of, you know.
Well, I mean, I understand why you wait. I mean, I really do. And it's like if I had that type of restraint, I mean, I mm-hmm. you know, my collection would be considerably less. It is.
Well, I know you have more DVDs than I do, but I mean, if you've known how much money I've spent on DVDs, it would probably be just as ridiculous.
Well, it's that kind of restraint you're talking about, which is the exact same reason I haven't bought Goodfellas yet,
mm-hmm.
even though they've been promising us a special edition for years and still have not given it to us.
Mm-hmm. There's the departure of Gandalf.
Yeah. Not to be seen again until, well, the end of the movie.
Mm.
This, and we were talking about the way you felt about the extended edition of this. And admittedly, no, it doesn't add a whole lot more to the plot the way Fellowship does.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, it's like, that's because of the fact that they really do touch on just about everything. Well, as far as Two Towers in the theatrical version, there's not a whole lot to really add, so it's just adding these little grace notes to and character moments that really just, you know, it's just all about deepening the characters in this one.
Viggo Mortensen owns the source now, I think.
Yeah.
I wonder if he bought the horse from Hildago.
I don't know.
Well, I like this moment. I wasn't aware that, you know, I mean, you know, supposedly the idea of, you know, speaking Elvish to a horse, you know, what that the effect it would have on the animal. I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Miranda Otto really did not get the credit she deserved for this movie, at least. Probably because it is a pretty limited role, you know, but she really does do a really good job laying down the foundation for this character.
Now, Brian, I remember you telling us in the Fellowship commentary about Christopher Lee and how one of the few reasons he's, you know, he's kept acting over the years is because of, like, you know, the audacity of, you know, certain directors' visions and so forth.
Yeah.
And I came across a movie the other day that kind of made me want to ask you this question. How did you get talked into doing Gremlins 2?
Gremlins 2. Was that by Dante?
Yeah, that was Joe Dante.
That might be why.
Yeah.
Well, Spielberg also, I mean, is producing it, too.
Yeah.
But,
do you remember? You played the Mad Scientist in Gremlins 2?
Now that I think about it, I do remember that. Yeah. My God. I can't believe I forgot. Well, actually, I'm not that shocked I forgot about. But
that's what I'm here for.
Man, I did forget he was in that.
Which, you know, when I...
It's one of the funnier sequels.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one of the more enjoyable sequels.
Yeah.
Granted, it didn't necessarily have to happen, but...
No, it really
was
didn't.
A fun one. Well, I mean, no, the thing we were talking about, I believe, with Christopher Lee was how he's been most impressed as far as, like, the complete devotion to the project, the way he's seen on Tim Burton and Sleepy Hollow and George Lucas on Star Wars and now Peter Jackson.
What always impresses me is some of the, you know, like Tolkien, he was initially just wanted to do like one giant book, at least this they're saying, you know, in the special features,
yeah,
rather than, you know, three separate books. And, you know, Lucas Star Wars wanted to do just all one big movie.
Yeah.
You know, some of my favorite authors who are on like book 10, book 11, mm-hmm. you know, who initially just wanted to do all one big book, you know, this sort of the scope that these guys are imagining. You know,
well, yeah,
and the fact that, you know, it has to be kind of pre-processed and fed to us mere mortals differently, you know, in order for us to understand it, or at least that's what a lot of people think.
Well, the thing is, it's like Tolkien said in his foreword to Lord of the Rings, he never intended it to be a trilogy.
Right, right.
It was turned into a trilogy because of the fact that. Because of the restrictions in terms of production of novels at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing with George Lucas and the Star Wars movies, if I'm not mistaken, is the fact that, you know, he knew he could not tell that whole story that he wanted to tell in one movie.
Right.
So he just took this part out, saved it for another time, you know. Okay, maybe I'll get to this part. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, well... But no, I see what you're saying, definitely. But it's like, the thing is, it's like they talk about in those things about Tolkien, how it's like, you know, trying to think of the titles of the three books. And it's like, you know, Fellowship of the Ring, okay. Return of the King, he wasn't a fan of because it told you what happened.
Yeah, he wanted
in
originally
Two Towers, it's like, eh.
he originally wanted the Return of the King to be called
War of the Ring. Yeah.
Didn't he?
Which actually, I think, and this is something I was going to talk about too. One of the this Two Towers has a.
I love this part when Christopher Lee just raises his eyebrow and he says, "There'll be women and children."
It's like,
oh,
the most sinister eyebrow raising since Jack Nicholson.
It's great.
I mean, but. I was going to mention that we hear for the first time Eowyn's theme in that scene she's got with Aragorn. Okay, what was I going to say? Okay, we were talking about the movie. We were talking about the trilogy. Mention that little thing about Howard Shore.
It's my fault again, isn't it?
No.
No, it is my fault.
But, well, I decided, listening back to episode one, it's like I'd finished my first point. I still can't remember what my second point was supposed to be, so I just left it. But, now I remember what I was talking about. Oh, yeah. The Two Towers has a fourth screenwriting credit in Stephen Sinclair. Actually, it was because of you that I was getting on the point that I was going to talk about. And Stephen Sinclair was a writer that was on the project when it was originally at Miramax and was originally going to be two books. This is what made me think about because of the fact that the first movie, or two movies, I should say, and because they were talking about the first, I remember Q&A, Ain't It Cool News did with Peter Jackson, where he talked about the first movie was going to be The Fellowship of the Ring. The second movie was going to be, they were talking about The War of the Ring. That's why I was going to get on.
Yeah, when it was originally going to be two movies.
Yes. And New Line said, well, three books, right? And it's like, well, why are you only making two movies? So
I really do enjoy listening to them tell that story in the extras in the Fellowship of the Ring DVD.
Yeah,
I mean it's just absolutely fascinating, just how they went from the original concept of just them doing two movies to, like, and because who were they originally with before New Line Cinema?
Miramax.
Yeah. Who just wanted them to do one movie, one big 3-hour movie. That's why they started shopping around for other.
Yeah. Miramax put in Turnaround, which is when New Line came in. And we just skipped the sequence where we really start to see the rift between Frodo and Sam as a result of Gollum. We cannot leave this sequence without talking about this sequence, which is the first time we got in the theatrical version where we got the interaction between Smeagol and Gollum. And the special features have the original Andy Serkis footage where you see Andy acting that out, and they played it side by side with this. It's absolutely amazing how he was able to do this, or how they were able to, how he made this sequence
work
possible.
Yeah.
And it really is a damn shame that Serkis didn't get nominated for Best Supporting Actor for this movie, because he is just absolutely phenomenal.
I mean, do you think we'll ever see a day when something like that is possible? I mean,
when they stop using actors on screen, just all together, which is what everybody was saying with Episode 1 in Final Fantasy, but it's not going to pan out anytime soon. But when they start using nothing but CG characters, then we'll have to see it. Before that, I'd be very surprised, which is a damn shame, because there are so many great... And you can't really... The problem is, you can't call this a voiceover performance because of the fact that it's so much more than just the voice. But it's one that's a strong, long one. You see the actor, but you hear his voice, and performance is just brilliant. I mean, and it's just really a shame that he didn't get nominated. And I think, you know, and the thing is, it's like, I can't remember who really won this year for supporting actor, but compared to Serkis, they didn't deserve it. Although I do think, God,
well, this movie did get, you know, a visual effects Oscar.
Visual effects and sound editing, which I do admit it deserved.
But, you know, I mean, if you know, it's kind of like, If you're gonna nominate, I mean, the closest thing you could get, you know, is a Best Visual Effects Oscar, you know, to give this character the credit it deserves.
No, the best thing you could do is an honorary Oscar or Special Achievement Oscar.
True, that's true. I didn't think about that, but you know,
that would have been the best way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, apparently winning Visual Effects Oscars 3 years in a row was enough.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, Peter Jackson didn't even get nominated for directing this, which I'm still baffled over.
It just goes back to the whole curse of the sequel thing. You know,
but see, you can't say that because of the Godfather trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And especially after what we saw this year,
mm-hmm.
which was unlike anything ever.
Well, 2002 was just a really off year, in my opinion, for film.
Actually, I thought it was, compared to last year's, actually a pretty damn good year. Yeah. There were, I mean, of the Best Picture nominees, I gave 4 out of 5 of them 4 stars.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them, and those 4 all ended up on my top 10 list.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what does that tell you? I mean,
I just didn't talk every year with too much of, you know, just because we had, what we had? We had Spider-Man, we had Episode 2.
Minority Report.
You know, adaptation.
I mean, I could go on.
Good.
But, you know, it would take forever. This part is in the movie.
Yes.
I do remember, or in the book.
Yes.
This part is in the book, especially the part with the Oliphants.
Yes.
And, you know, seeing how Oliphants sort of pay off in Return of the King. you know, how you see them used in the war is just stunning. And you really do kind of feel the awe that Sam has in this scene of seeing them.
There's a really cute story that Sean Astin tells in the cast commentary about how this scene was originally shot a different way, and and, you know, how in between the time of the principal photography and the reshoots, Sean Astin got a fan letter from somebody who was supposedly, I think, was dying of cancer or something like that, and they tell Sean Astin in the letter that they're really anticipating the moment in Two Towers when Sam first sees an elephant.
I do remember that now. That
yeah,
you
and
the,
how
yeah.
Sean Astin was just totally gratified by how, you know, the moment was reshot.
Yeah,
and during pickups, and just a cute little story.
Yeah. David Wenham as Faramir. Unfortunately, I have no idea what else he's been in.
I love that line.
Yeah.
Now, that's the thing. I mean, the whole extended version versus the theatrical version. Would you or would you not, you know, if you weren't familiar with the books, you know, would you be slightly put off by this little sonnet by Faramir?
You know, I mean, I think because of one of the ideas of the war is, you know, how bad are the bad guys really? You know, I mean, you know, he was saying, you know, this guy had no less of a sense of duty than anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, he had a name, probably a family, just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's probably one of the ideas that Tolkien wanted to get across.
Yeah.
You know, and you see guys who were in war before that are now writing books say the same type, do the same mm-hmm. type of thing. So I think that was valid, whether or not I don't even remember that in the book or not. I don't know.
I don't remember if it's in the book or not, but. We can continue this on disc 2 since we're already at the little menu thing there. So
we have a tendency to do that, don't we?
Yeah,
I mean,
a lot.
I mean, you know, I mean, why not?